I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow in Washington, D.C., three U.S. presidents will address jobs and justice on the same day and date as the 1963 March on Washington. Tonight, PBS will air a new documentary about the march, as will Milwaukee Public Television. And this hour, we remember the civil rights history of 50 years ago. Professor Claiborne Carson is featured prominently in the PBS documentary. He marched on that day. He was a young man. He was selected by Mrs. Coretta Scott King to edit and publish the papers of her husband. Professor Carson is now a member of Stanford University's Department of History. He has devoted most of his professional life to the study of Martin Luther King. The King Papers Project has produced six volumes of speeches, sermons, correspondence, and unpublished writings. He's also the author of In Struggle, SNCC and the Black Awakening of the 1960s, Martin's Dream, My Journey and the Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, The FBI File, and African American Lives, The Struggle for Freedom. He was a senior historical advisor for a 14-part public TV series titled Eyes on the Prize. Later this hour, Joanne Williams, host of Milwaukee Public Television's Black Nouveau, Tonight for Jobs and Freedom, will air on MPTV, and the program features the involvement of local citizens and interviews also with several of the organizers of the march. We'll be welcoming your phone calls during the course of this hour. Perhaps some of you listening did march in Washington. We would be interested in hearing from you, and many of you, of course, are interested in the subject matter of this hour. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Claiborne Carson, hello, and thank you so much for being with us.
Good to talk to you, Kathleen.
I had a chance to watch the documentary last night and think it's very important and very good. You are featured prominently in it, and you went to the march, but it was one of those things where you were looking around for a ride, and you were lucky you found one. Can you tell me how old you were and what made you decide you had to be there?
I was 19, and I had grown up in a small town in New Mexico, Los Alamos, and there were only three black families there.
Oh.
So much of what I knew about black Americans and the black community really came from the newspapers and magazines. I knew about the black entertainers who sometimes were on the Ed Sullivan Show and things like that.
Mm.
But beyond that, I knew about this burgeoning movement that was going on in the South, and the fact that young people, not that much older than I was, were playing leading roles in this movement, and that was exciting to me, and I admired them a great deal, and I guess I wanted to be like them, and I felt that the time had come to bring about the end of this Jim Crow system that was in the South, of segregation and discrimination, and they were playing important roles, and I wanted to play an important role myself.
Mm.
So going to the march seemed like a natural thing, even though it was thousands of miles away from my home. But I found a way to get to a student conference in Indiana, and then found a ride on a bus that was chartered by the NAACP group in Indianapolis, and went on an overnight bus and got out of the bus the next morning, and there I was in the middle of the march.
Got out of the bus, and I would imagine into the rest of your life, I would imagine that this day, 50 years ago, tomorrow, was really important in your life, was it?
Yeah, well, the book that you mentioned, the Martin's Dream, really covers the last 50 years of my life since that day. Chapter one is going to the march. And many of the chapters kind of center on going back to that same place, the Washington Mall, for so many events. I was just there this weekend for the commemoration. But, you know, when I'm at the mall, I realize that so many things have changed. We were a pretty powerless group, even though we were numerous. We were at one end of the mall and the Capitol was at the other, and we didn't know whether the Civil Rights Act was going to pass in 1964.
Right.
There were only five black members of Congress. there was hardly any sense of that of so many of the changes that have occurred over the last 50 years. And certainly there was no indication back then that 45 years later I would come and back to the mall and watch the inauguration of an African-American president.
Absolutely. I was struck. I'm always struck by John Lewis. Every time I hear him, I just kind of cry, actually. But
yeah.
at the end of the film, when he talks about getting on an airplane frequently and seeing the statue of Martin Luther King between the Lincoln Monument and the Jefferson Monument, and there he is, tall and looking forever. He'll look forever at that very important ground and all the people who will see him. And he realizes it's a fine way to end the film, because it was 50 years ago that everybody paid all this attention to him, and now there's this statue. And on some level, you have to say, it's been a long struggle, but there have been advancements.
And for me, it's particularly poignant because I helped design that memorial.
Did you really? I didn't know that.
That's another chapter in my book about being involved in designing the King Memorial. There was an international competition, and I worked with a San Francisco design firm, and of the 900 applicants, our design won. So I could see some of my ideas about Martin Luther King literally set in stone.
Oh, my, Professor Carson, you're a man of a lot of accomplishments. The film starts, and I know that you pay tribute in the film to the young people who continued marching after Martin Luther King was jailed for marching in Birmingham, Alabama. Things started in Birmingham. Birmingham was on national TV. Bull Connor and his dogs were on national TV. Can you talk about how... what was going on in Birmingham just prior to this March on Washington, and how it figures so prominently in the months that followed, and the months after, actually, the March on Washington?
Well, the point I make in the film is that these teenagers basically saved the movement, saved Martin Luther King's career,
mm-hmm.
because he had a lot at stake in Birmingham. He had not achieved a great success after Montgomery, and that had been 6 years earlier. Almost 7 years earlier. And if he had lost in Birmingham, there probably wouldn't be a I Have a Dream speech, and there certainly wouldn't be a King National Holiday or a Nobel Peace Prize. And yet, when he went to jail, and that's where he wrote his letter from Birmingham jail, the outcome of the Birmingham campaign was still very much in doubt, and it was the emergence of these young people who were the only ones left willing to be arrested. There were no adults left who were willing to go to jail, and so they were the ones who sustained the movement especially in May of 1963. And brought about a victory, captured victory from the jaws of defeat, that probably would have marked the end of King's career as a leader who had the greatest influence over the movement.
Hmm. And had they been trained in nonviolent resistance?
Yes, that's an important story, and it needs to be told about the role of the King's associates, Dorothy Cotton, and many others who conducted these nonviolent workshops. And even before Martin Luther King went to jail, they had been saying, we've got to let these teenagers, high school students, some of them not even in high school, we've got to let them play a role. And Martin Luther King was actually somewhat skeptical about using the energy of these young people, but by the end of May, they were somewhat desperate, and I think that it's interesting that both with Nelson Mandela and Martin Luther King, at crucial points in their career, they're in jail,
yes.
and it's young people,
right.
Still in their teenage years, who really revive a movement that was in danger of of just not being able to succeed in its goals. And it, and I sometimes think that, you know, we have it wrong. We kind of think of these great leaders and their followers and see the leader taking, always taking the lead. But in this case, both of them really couldn't take the lead in the way we think of it. They were in jail. Their freedom was limited. It was young people taking the initiative and making it possible for the leaders to succeed.
The leaders also had to respond to all of these events. I guess I had forgotten how they happened so close together. Medgar Evers killed in June. There were demonstrations in many cities in the country. The president is kind of wishy-washy on civil rights. King is calling for a second Emancipation Proclamation. Bull Connor, as I mentioned earlier, putting the dogs on these young people who are marching and all those people being arrested. So all of this was happening in those really intense months right before the march, wasn't it?
Yes, and in so many different cities. And this was national. It wasn't just
yes,
Southern.
Yes.
There were protests against segregated schools in Chicago. There were protests against job discrimination and other forms of housing discrimination in places like California and especially in the Bay Area. In New York, there were massive demonstrations. It's been estimated that there more than well over a million people were involved in these demonstrations during the spring and summer of 1963. So when you look at it from that perspective, you can see that the March on Washington was a culmination of all of this activity at the grassroots level.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what made the march so successful.
And is it fair to say that President Kennedy's hand was forced, particularly when the University of Alabama refused to allow black students, that really forced him to take some kind of stand and make a national pronouncement? And then I wonder if that was important in a large way.
I think that was crucial. President Kennedy did not want civil rights issues to be the high priority in his presidency. He wanted foreign policy issues to be a much higher priority. So it was the fact that I think the South overplayed its hand. I think that if there had been moderation on the civil rights issue, but when you have a governor basically setting himself up and saying, I don't have to obey a court order like George Wallace did by standing in the schoolhouse door, then President Eisenhower and President Kennedy, they feel they have to act. I mean, that's what the Civil War was fought over. So he was kind of forced into action, and once he was forced into action, I think that he was the first president to identify civil rights reform as a moral crusade, as a moral necessity. And I think from that point on, there was no question of what side the federal government was on.
Mm-hmm. And Professor Carson, who had the idea of let's do this massive march on Washington, and how was the message of the march crafted, and did that message change as plans were underway?
Well, one thing that I think is often overlooked is that it was a march on Washington for jobs and freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And the jobs part sometimes gets skipped over. But for A. Philip Randolph, who was probably the central figure, I think definitely the central figure in mobilizing the march, it wasn't Martin Luther King. A. Philip Randolph was a longtime labor leader. His career as an activist goes back to World War I. He had used the threat of a march in 1941 to gain concessions on jobs issues in the war industries from Franklin Roosevelt.
Hmm.
So he knew that the protest and demonstrations were an effective way of getting the attention of a president and pushing a president into action. So in 1963, it was fairly natural that he would revive this idea of a march on Washington and say that the time has come for a new march on Washington 2 decades after I tried this before. And And like the earlier march, it was designed to get as many people to build a coalition, labor, religious groups, various kinds of activist groups, all of them coming together. They don't agree about everything, and one of the things behind the scenes, this coalition was a fragile coalition. They were always arguing about various aspects of what the goal should be. But the one goal that they could agree on was that the time had come to end the Jim Crow system in the South. They might differ on whether to have a Bill of Rights for the disadvantaged and various kinds of goals that were central to Randolph and central to King.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly there was no difference over Jim Crow has to end.
Mm-hmm. And we are reminded of this in the documentary. We now have all this instant communication, of course, the internet, and we can organize people almost instantaneously. But what a huge effort all over the country it was to get 250,000 people in Washington. That was quite some organization, wasn't it?
Yes, and that's one of the interesting things about the documentary is it just shows that, you know, a lot of this was people-to-people effort. There were, as you said, none of the things that we take for granted, the internet and social networking and all of that sort of thing. This was people getting on the telephone, talking to other people, traveling about the country, and convincing people to charter a bus and come there. And it was an unprecedented mobilization, especially of the African American community, with the help of its allies in these various other religious groups. You know, there had been a long history of Northern civil rights activity of trying to get anti-discrimination bills passed in state legislatures. So all of that kind of brought hundreds of thousands of people into this effort eventually. And the coalition held, at least for that day. It, as I said, it was fragile, and in the years afterwards, it began to come apart. But at least for that period of 1963 to 1965, when the Voting Rights Act was passed, that was the coalition that made possible some of the most momentous legislation that this nation has ever seen, and not just legislation to affect African Americans. The lives of women were deeply affected. The Civil Rights Act, the provision against discrimination on grounds of gender, affected far more white women than affected African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
The Immigration Act, which removed racial quotas from our immigration laws, has created the nation that we see around us today. There would be many people who would not be in the United States except for the Immigration Act. And I live in Silicon Valley, and I can tell you that Silicon Valley would be a much different place if not for that. So I think that one of the things that we should really think about in terms of commemorating this day is that it should not be simply a commemoration by black Americans. A very large proportion, the majority of the population of the United States, there are people whose lives were positively affected by the fact that this country became a more fair and just society.
Professor Claiborne Carson is our guest for most of this hour, featured pretty prominently on tonight's PBS documentary, The March. He is a member of Stanford's Department of History, but he's done so many things. I didn't even know he'd done some of these prominent things, like design the Martin Luther King statue in Washington, D.C. He's written many, many books. His latest is Martin's Dream, My Journey and the Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., and it traces his life from a 19-year-old in the 1963 March on Washington to an internationally known Martin Luther King scholar. He was selected in 1985 by Mrs. Coretta Scott King to edit and publish the papers of her late husband. He is now the director of the Martin Luther King Research and Education Institute at Stanford University, the founding director. We welcome your phone calls as we think about history of 50 years ago this week and how it will be marked tomorrow and how it's been marked in many, many ways with books and documentaries and TV specials and gatherings of large numbers of people in Washington to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the march. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Would you agree that the legislation that was passed in the years immediately following this march were very, very significant to defining who America was to become in a better sense? And maybe some of you were there and would like to tell us about your experience. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Mahalia Jackson, one of the participants, important participant in that March on Washington 50 years ago tomorrow. She was really important, wasn't she? There is something that's memorable and important about having big names, people who have souls of immense goodness and terrific voices like Mahalia and Joan Baez and other performers who were there that I don't know if it lends legitimacy, but it really enters the hearts of the crowd gathered, don't you think, Professor?
I think so. I think very much so that it was important to have the cultural leaders in support of this great movement. People like Harry Belafonte, mm-hmm. whose role can't be overstated. These were people who took risk with their career, and this tradition goes back to Paul Robeson, back in the 1940s, particularly, when he put his own career at risk to take a stand with the movement for change, and of course this set a model that still affects entertainment figures today. I mean, whether they want to live up to that model is another issue, but at least they have these role models like Paul Robeson and Harry Belafonte and many others who aided the movement in so many different ways. First of all, just simply by lending their presence at key moments like the March on Washington. There was a whole plane load of entertainment figures, white as well as black, who came out from Hollywood to take part in the march. And I think it was crucial to have a Paul Newman or
even Charlton Heston was there.
Charlton Heston was there. There were many of them who simply by their presence said that this is not just a black campaign for advancement. This is something that has to do with the idea of fairness in American society. And I think that was crucial. And of course for those like myself who went, these were people I had only seen on the Ed Sullivan Show, so I was as wide-eyed as anybody there, to see for the first time with my own eyes, and to listen to someone like Joan Baez or Bob Dylan or Peter, Paul, and Mary, and even just a month ago, I spent some time with Joan Baez, who lives out here, and she. she talked about it being one of the great moments of her life.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she's had a very special life.
Right.
But that moment of getting up and leading the crowd and singing We Shall Overcome and singing by herself All My Trials, you know,
mm-hmm.
that she said that she was very proud of the fact that she helped contribute to making it a biracial march,
mm-hmm.
That her fans and the fans of these other people would join, not just because the entertainers were there, but because they symbolically represented the fact that this was not simply a black cause.
Right. And they showed up in some pretty tough areas in the South to sing those songs as well.
Exactly. I mean, these were people who, you know, again, represent a tradition of at least among some entertainers, of identifying with unpopular causes.
Yeah.
Pete Seeger, you know, I guess would be a great
mm-hmm.
example of that, who I have a film clip of him in Mississippi singing to sharecroppers. So this is, and of course Joan Baez took part in the Selma to Montgomery march in 1965.
Let's go to some phone calls for you. Our number is 800-486-8655. Vivian in Green Bay. Hi, Vivian.
Hello. Two comments about probably being one of the first women who was impacted by the change in the civil rights law. I'm white. My first job after high school in 1964 was at a local utility, electric gas utility. And to be hired, you needed to agree to quit when you married. The civil rights law changed that. I noticed the impact on the company, though. There were a lot of young women there. They lost a lot of talent. They said the belief was that women should be in the home. And after 4 years, I became bored. I was married. After 5 years, I left because that policy had created a ceiling for most of us young women. There was nowhere to go. They weren't used to dealing with the great number of women who stayed on board and the few positions for women that were of any noteworthiness were already taken by women who hadn't married. So it handicapped the company, I think, and it was a great experience for me, but I was very grateful to have the opportunity to stay there had I wished to.
Mm-hmm.
I think Vivian's story is something that should be heard by every young woman today because, you know, it's easy to forget where your rights come from, you know, that they were,
yes.
There was a struggle that brought about equality in the workplace, and that the March on Washington, again, was for jobs and freedom. It was a march that involved labor unions and that these changes, which so many people benefit from today, are often the beneficiaries have no conception of their indebtedness to a Martin Luther King. And I think that that's when we'll really begin to understand his importance when white Americans and Asian Americans and Latino Americans all understand that he is one of our nation's founders. He helped create a more democratic society.
Mm-hmm.
I think that after the mid-1960s, we had the right to call ourselves a true democracy because that was when the nation shifted. And over the last 50 years, that's one of the things I point out in my book, is not that these changes affected me. I couldn't, when I was at the march as a 19-year-old, I couldn't imagine being a professor of African-American history at Stanford University.
No, of course.
Because in 1963, there were no black professors at
right.
Stanford University. So these changes affected my life and the lives of so many people,
mm-hmm.
some of whom are just not aware of how much they were impacted.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Vivian, so much for your call. Sue in Portage, hi.
Hi. I think it's while it's important to acknowledge the incredible wonderfulness of the civil rights movement and all. I think it's really important that we also, during this hour, look at the current situation around the country. There are many, many states that are putting in great voter suppression laws, and also the Supreme Court has really done some bad things to the Voter Rights Act. So I think we need to consider that also and not just spend the whole hour sort of congratulating ourselves on progress made.
Oh, I'm certain if Martin Luther King were still around, he would not be celebrating the Martin Luther King of 1963. He would be in the forefront of trying to. I think he'd be disappointed that we're defending old ground, defending gains that we thought that we had won, and certainly the right to vote. The notion that anyone in 2013 for just to gain a political advantage would take steps that will suppress voter turnout rather than expand voter turnout. That seems to me to be a basically un-American and certainly undemocratic idea. We should be encouraging people to vote. We should be thinking about expanding voting over a weekend so that people don't have to lose time at work. We should be working to make it so that people don't have to stand in long lines in order to vote, that we should recognize that we're a very mobile society and not have long periods between voter registration and voting. You know, there's so many ways we could increase voting, and why, well, I know why, but I think that any political party that tries to gain a political advantage by suppressing the vote should be punished by all voters, that should be considered un-American and certainly not rewarded in elections.
Thanks, Sue, for the call. I'm wondering about Dr. Martin Luther King's response to the idea of a massive march like this. Was he reluctant to endorse this, or did he say right at the very beginning, let's go?
Oh, Martin Luther King was enthusiastic about it. I think that he understood that bring all of this energy that he was seeing at the grassroots level in Birmingham and other places, you've got to bring it to Washington. And that's where he probably disagreed with Kennedy. Kennedy thought it might be counterproductive to have protests, and particularly did not want to have the sense that black protesters were on the steps of the Capitol and, you know, as if Congress could be intimidated by that. So that's one of the reasons why it was actually held at the other end of the mall at the Lincoln Memorial, which turned out to be a wonderful location because it had all that symbolic importance.
Yes, yes.
But I think many of the protesters would have preferred to be on the steps of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them wanted to do civil disobedience, and some wanted to do kind of a version of the Occupy movement, just occupy the mall until the bill was passed. And it took a lot of persuasion to say, yes, we're going to have this one-day march. We're going to have it about as far away from Congress as you can get on the mall. And everyone is supposed to be home by sundown. That took a lot of effort on the part of the march leaders to keep everybody in agreement on that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after that, this was a fragile coalition. It began to come apart. You could see that even at the march about the argument over John Lewis's speech.
His speech, yeah.
Because John Lewis represented the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and you know, they had staged sit-ins in the Justice Department, and they were not satisfied with Kennedy's civil rights legislation because it did not include strong protections of the right to vote.
Mm-hmm.
They felt that Kennedy should have gone much further. So you had a wide range, and of course you had Malcolm X at the, you know, he didn't participate in the march, but he was there in Washington, and he was arguing that that it should have been an even more militant event. So all that was there. But I think for that one magic day, that coalition held together.
Yes, it is.
It was always in, always fragile, but you know, when I was there, one of the things that was so striking was that, you know, all these different kinds of people, you know, from sharecroppers from Mississippi to
middle-class
black families,
mm-hmm.
to union workers, to religious activists, or representatives of different religious faiths, you know, all of them marched together.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Andrew in Monroe next. Hi, Andrew.
Hello. I just have a couple of quick questions for the guest. Say, with all this, ever since with this anniversary coming up for the march, it seems like there's a lot more in the news. Mostly, like, things have come up, racial issues, such as the Trayvon Martin. There was a few others. Just recently in the news, there was a white guy, a vet, that was beaten by a couple of blacks. And you hear a lot about that when with this going on. You don't hear whenever something happens to do as far as white on black race. It seems to just kind of blow out. But when it's the other way, when it's black on white, then it's kind of held under the, well.
All right, Claiborne Carson, you want to respond to that?
Well, I think that, you know, you're getting into what gets covered and what gets not. I mean, one of the points is what's considered more unusual sometimes is what is considered newsworthy, and certainly the notion of a in Trayvon Martin case, the notion of a white person, you know, in a neighborhood watch group shooting a person who was simply visiting there, you know, that was something that stood out. And crime is, you know, for all the talk about interracial crime, most crime is within races. Most black violence is against other black people, and certainly the same about most white violence. But I think that the news media does pick out certain, you know, there's a lot of young black men who are getting killed, and their name is not Trayvon Martin.
Let me ask you, in the minute that we have left, the press is also paid a lot of attention, witnessed the PBS documentary. Milwaukee Public Television will be doing a documentary we'll talk about in a few minutes. CNN did a special I saw. It's been all over the news for weeks now. Why are we remembering this particular anniversary with so much press?
I think that, the March on Washington was a very special moment in American history.
Mm-hmm.
And that the race issue doesn't go away. But during that time, the Jim Crow system in the South went away. And I think that was a major turning point for the nation. That this system that had been set up such that, you know, for me growing up, the notion of our family kind of taking a vacation in the South was inconceivable. You know, I think that my mother, who grew up in the rural South, and my father, his family, he was one generation removed from the South. The South was a place you wanted to get away from.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly never visit, because, you know, where would you stay? Where would you eat?
Right,
all of
right.
these kinds of questions. So the notion that one generation of Americans, very brave people of a variety of races, most of them black, though, fought a battle to end this system. And they succeeded. They overcame it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
now,
that's quite a story.
That's something that is worth celebrating.
Right.
Just like the end of the Civil War or any other great event in American history.
Yeah. Well, we'll look forward to seeing you again tonight in the wonderful documentary. And thank you very, very much, Professor Claiborne Carson, for being with us this day.
It's great to talk to you.
Claiborne Carson, you will see him on the PBS documentary tonight, The March. He's also author of many, many books, but if you're particularly interested in this part of history, his book, Martin's Dream, My Journey and the Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. is a memoir that traces his life from being a 19-year-old who was at the 1963 March on Washington to becoming an internationally known King scholar. Milwaukee Public Television also has a documentary tonight, and we will be talking about that with Joanne Williams, who is the host of the documentary, and we'll do that in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
Tonight, Black Nouveau on Milwaukee Public Television will present For Jobs and Freedom, 50 Years and Counting. It features organizers of the march and people from Wisconsin who march. The program airs on MPTV tonight at 7 and tomorrow, the actual anniversary, at 6:30. Joanne Williams is host of the documentary, and she's here to talk about the interviews that she did and where all those took place and the significance of the documentary and this time in our history. Joanne, hello. Thank you so much for being with us. She's not there yet. All right, we'll find Joanne in just one moment. Some of the Wisconsin people who she has interviewed include labor leader David Newby, Vel Phillips, who evidently went at the insistence of Thurgood Marshall, William Jones from UW-Madison, author of The March on Washington, and a number of other people as well. Black Nouveau has been in Milwaukee for a long, long time and doing wonderful documentary work. Their special Freedom Walkers for Milwaukee will air after this March show, which is also an interesting documentary as well. And Joanne is with us now. Hi, Joanne. Hi, thank you so much for being with us.
Sure.
The more I talk about this, the more I realize what a significant event this was in history. You had a chance to interview some of the organizers of this, including Congressman John Lewis and Wisconsin, prominent Wisconsin people. Tell me who all you talked to and those interviews that really stay with you and will always stay with you.
Well, of course, there is John Lewis, who's the last surviving organizer of the March on Washington. He's a congressman right now. We had a fascinating discussion, and that's part of the program. I also talked to Vel Phillips, a name that should be familiar to everyone.
Yes.
In Milwaukee, who went to the march at the invitation of Thurgood Marshall of the NAACP. I talked with David Newby, who was a college student at the time of the march and came from Boston to Washington, D.C., was inspired by the march and went on to become the president of the Wisconsin AFL-CIO. We talked with Ted Mack from Milwaukee, who was the leader of CORE, Congress of Racial Equality.
Mm.
He went to the march, and then, of course, he went on to be a businessman here in the Milwaukee area. We talked with George Paz Martin, a man from Milwaukee who was a member of St. Boniface Church and a follower of Father Grappi, told us his experience of how Father Grappi picked him up in the station wagon and didn't tell him where he was going. He was on the way to Washington. We also talked to Lynn Hughes, who is the founder of the Pullman Porter Museum in Chicago, and Harry Rubenstein, who is one of the co-curators of the Emancipation Proclamation / March on Washington display at the Smithsonian Institute.
Mm. It's one of those events. I'm old enough to have been at that event, but I wasn't there. I was still in school, certainly. But the more I hear people express what happened to them, just emotionally, when they were there, it must have been an extraordinary thing to be a part of, don't you think?
Well, all the people I talked to were struck, first of all, by the number of people who came.
Right.
The organizers hoped for 100,000 people. In 1941, when A. Philip Randolph said he was going to have a march on Washington, and then it was postponed because President Roosevelt did sign the order to stop discrimination in hiring practices, they expected 100,000 people. They hoped for that in 1963, and they got 250,000, probably more if you look at the picture. So the folks from Wisconsin who went there were overwhelmed by the number of people that they saw, the number of people who were just arriving, bus after bus after bus. And one thing that was important that Ted Mack mentioned to us was that the people who came to the march were told, dress in your Sunday best. They were told to put on their dresses, their hats, their gloves. Men wore suits and ties because they were told that they were there for business.
Oh.
So if you look at the pictures of the march,
yes,
notice how the people were dressed.
Yes, that's something I hadn't noticed at all. Tell me about Wisconsin participants. Were there many?
There were a lot, and I was only able to find the ones that we have in tonight's special program on Channel 10. David Newby, Vel Phillips, Ted Mack, and George Paz Martin. But since we have finished the program, I've met several others who have come to me and said, I heard you were looking for people who went to the march, and I was there, and I'd like to talk to you about it. They can't be in the show because the show is finished, but there are many more people in the Milwaukee area who attended the march who I hope will watch tonight and tomorrow night and share with their families and friends what their experiences were in Washington.
And certainly, Milwaukee was going through some fairly turbulent times during the civil rights struggle. You mentioned Father Grappi gathering up people to go to Washington, D.C. I know Black Nouveau is going to air a documentary on 4 days after the march, Father Grappi Bridge, the march that was conducted there, and tracing Milwaukee's very turbulent civil rights struggle.
Right. Well, tonight's programming schedule begins at 7 o'clock on Channel 10 with the special on the march that we've produced. We went to Washington, we went to Chicago, we went to Atlanta, and we talked to people here in Wisconsin and Madison and Milwaukee for tonight's special. That will be followed at 7:30 with the special we did 2 years ago called Freedom Walkers for Milwaukee, which was about the open housing marches. That'll be followed by special concert from Washington, D.C., and performance at the White House.
Mm.
And then at 9 o'clock tonight will be the program, The March, that you've just been talking to with your author,
mm-hmm.
which was produced by Robert Redford. What's interesting about the Freedom Walkers for Milwaukee is it does deal with Father Grappi and the Freedom Walkers. It was Vel Phillips' insistence in the Milwaukee Common Council during the time of the march and after the march that got the open housing law passed in the city of Milwaukee. The people who went to the march were given a list of demands, and they were also told to go back to your community and do something to make a difference. And this is one of the things that she did. And when you meet people who went to the march, they might not have done big things, but they did a little something to make a difference when they got home.
And how would you define this as kind of a new time in American history, that King in this march really made an American dream available not only to African Americans but to women and to other minority groups? It was extraordinarily significant.
It was significant for every American, even if they don't realize it now. If they look back at the rights and freedoms that they now enjoy and look at what was requested by the marchers, you'll find something that touches almost everybody, touches women, touches people of color, touches Native Americans, touches people with disabilities, touches gay and lesbian people. Everybody has benefited from the March on Washington and the legislation that came out of that march. Of course, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 came out of the March on Washington. So everybody, white, black, any other color, has benefited from what happened on the mall that day.
Yeah. Well, it's worth marking. I'm so glad you did the documentary. I really look forward to seeing it tonight, Joanne, and thank you so much for being with us.
Sure. Thank you very much, Kathleen. Anytime.
Black Nouveau on Milwaukee Public Television, presenting for Jobs and Freedom. Host Joanne Williams with us. The program airs on Milwaukee Public Television. You can see it online, too, if you're in different parts of the state, tonight at 7 and tomorrow, the actual anniversary, at 6:30 in the evening. And after 3 on Central Time, Rob Ferret and Veronica Rickert will also be looking at the anniversary of the March on Washington with attention to the I Have a Dream speech. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley for producing this program. And thank you very much for listening with listening tomorrow. Syria, of course, is what we'll be talking about the first hour of our program.